he started getting relentless. And I'm like, why is he insisting that we have to rehearse the damn kiss? I mean, it's just it's like a fake kiss, right? Yeah. This is all I could think about. I'm like, good God, Al, you know, it's not SNL, for goodness sakes, right? We're not doing this thing for real. This is just a live thing in front of troops. It doesn't matter, you know? And he's like, Leanne, you know, actors, we have to rehearse everything. You have to rehearse the kiss. And just to make it go away and to make him stop, I'm like, okay, well, rehearse the damn kiss, you know? And it happened so fast that as I'm like, okay, we're going to rehearse the kiss, you know, and as we're coming in, he comes up and he grabs me and he puts his hand behind my head and he aggressively comes in and he mashes his mouth up against mine and he sticks his tongue in my mouth.
KABC radio host Leanne Tweeden telling her story about how Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken aggressively kissed her back in 2006. Tweeden also shared a picture of Franken apparently grabbing her breasts while she was asleep. Franken was a comedian at the time. The two were on a trip to entertain the troops in the Middle East. In a statement, Franken said while he didn't remember the incident the same way she did, he is sorry, and he says he welcomes an ethics investigation. Up until now, Congress has seemed to have dodged the national reckoning on sexual assault that exploded with the Harvey Weinstein scandal, but that may be coming to an end as more women at the Capitol start to discuss what one California congresswoman calls a breeding ground for a hostile work environment. Joining us to talk about that is Gabe DeBenedetti, national political reporter for Politico. Hi.
Hey there.
Well, let's go over this story today, these specific allegations against Al Franken. She's just the only woman who has stepped forward?
That seems right. Yes. At the moment, she's the only woman who's stepped forward. And this is the first time that we've seen a member of Congress on the Senate or House side directly accused of something like this, at least in this latest wave of people talking about this issue. This is an incident that allegedly happened quite some time ago, certainly before Franken was a senator. But he was very quick to say, you know, not necessarily he apologized. He didn't necessarily say that it didn't happen, just that he remembered it differently. And now he has offered himself up for an ethics investigation. And even fellow Democrats are very quick to say, yes, you have to be investigated by the ethics committee and nothing good is going to come of this.
And then some people have said he should resign. Is that something that could happen?
It certainly could happen. It's not seriously been batted around by fellow Democrats or even that many Republican senators on Capitol Hill, though it certainly has been something that some commentators have been talking about. And from the perspective, from the purely political perspective, there are plenty of Democrats that would want to see that happen just because they think this is going to be a big problem for them politically, where a lot of them are going after Republicans such as Roy Moore, the Senate candidate in Alabama right now, for his own improprieties, and they don't want to have to be defending one of their own.
Right. So what has been the difference, if there has been a difference, in terms of the reaction when you look at the Moore story and this Franken story?
Well, for one, the Moore story is quite a bit different. Moore's accusers are talking about him acting inappropriately towards them, making inappropriate sexual advances, and in two cases, accusing him of sexual assault when they were minors. This is something different that Franken is being accused of. This is an inappropriate incident from just a few years ago. The accuser is not a minor. And Moore, of course, is an extremely controversial figure among both Republicans and Democrats. The difference is, of course, he's not a senator yet. He's running, and Republicans are trying to make sure that he never does make it to the Senate. So that's a pretty big difference so far. Relative to the Moore situation, the responses to Franken have been pretty uniform. Everyone is condemning this and saying, essentially, he needs to be investigated, and he has apologized profusely.
And he has said he would welcome an investigation himself.
That's right. Obviously, it's not going to stop there. I mean, this is a huge problem for him, for Democrats, and for the United States Senate, because it exposes a problem that a lot of people have been talking about privately, but not talking about publicly, which is that, as some members of Congress have said, the Senate and Capitol Hill could be a breeding ground for this kind of behavior.
Well, some people did talk about it publicly this week, and that would be Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier of California and Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock of Virginia. They both spoke at a House hearing this week, and here's a little bit of what they said.
In fact, there are two members of Congress, Republican and Democrat, right now, who serve.
This member asked a staffer to bring them over some materials to their residence and was greeted with a member in a towel, who was a male, who then invited her in. At that point, he decided to expose himself.
Okay, so that is Congresswoman Comstock there. Earlier, we heard from Congresswoman Speer saying that there are two lawmakers who are known sexual harassers, but they didn't name who they were. Why didn't they name them?
Well, you'd have to ask them. Obviously, this is an extremely sensitive situation for everyone involved. And in many cases, the accusers don't want to come forth publicly and talk about these accusations in a way where it could be revealed who they actually are for any number of reasons. But the reality is that this is a environment where you have a number of men who are in a lot of power and who are not frequently, you know, there are not many checks on those down that power, and it's unfortunate, and it's extremely unfortunate that this has turned into an environment where this kind of thing happens and people don't talk about it out loud. So that's changing.
Right, right. And so Speer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, they both announced this bill called the Me Too Congress Act, which would make the process of reporting these acts, sexual impropriety, harassment, et cetera, more transparent, and require sexual harassment training for lawmakers.
And that's right.
Is that gonna? What are the bill's chances?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that everyone wants something like that to pass right now. There have already been new rules put in place that require sexual harassment training, not only for members of Congress but for staffers on Capitol Hill. And one of the important pieces of context to all this is that scandals like this have actually been playing out in state legislatures across the country for the last few weeks as well. So this is really a problem for the entire political class, if not the entire society. And these pieces of legislation like this and proposals like this are a reflection of the understanding in the political world that this is a major problem that needs to be reckoned with as soon as possible.
So what is the sense there on Capitol Hill, that more women will come forward and actually start naming names?
That's certainly something that a lot of people are throwing out there as a possibility. No one really knows what's going to come next, and particularly in the case of Senator Franken, no one knows if there will be any more accusations or if this was the one that was going to stand alone. But there's certainly a feeling that, you know, as the two congresswomen said publicly, this is a big problem, and there are a number of people who could be implicated if there are more women who come forward. That certainly seems to be the tide, and that remains to be seen what exactly that's going to look like on Capitol Hill. But, you know, plenty of people are holding their breath.
Gabe DiBenedetti, national political reporter for Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's next for the three UCLA basketball players who shoplifted in China? We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'd like to start off by saying sorry for stealing from the stores in China. I didn't exercise my best judgment, and I was wrong for that. I apologize to my family, my coaches, my teammates, and UCLA for letting so many people down. I also apologize to the people of China for causing them so much trouble. I'm a young man, however, it's not an excuse for making a really stupid decision.
That's LeAngelo Ball. He and his two UCLA teammates, Jalen Hill and Cody Riley, are back from China. UCLA held a press conference yesterday in which the three freshmen apologized to everyone for shoplifting from stores near their hotel. They were also careful to thank President Trump, who reportedly reached out on their behalf to help get them released and come home. Earlier in the day, he had tweeted, "Do you think that three UCLA basketball players will say thank you, President Trump? They were headed for 10 years in jail!" Exclamation point. LA Times sports columnist Bill Plaschke has been following the story. He's here now. Hi.
Hey.
Okay.
Your day at UCLA. Your day.
I know. So first of all, that wasn't really a press conference because they didn't take questions, right?
Right. So I wasn't sure what to call that, but by taking no questions, they certainly raised many, many questions.
Okay, so what are the questions that raised for you?
The main question is the suspension. The penalty was uncertain. They're suspended indefinitely, And that could mean 10 games. That could mean 2 months. That could mean, it should mean, the rest of the season. I think a lot of people involved in UCLA and a lot of people in the city who admire what the university stands for and what its the athletic programs have stood for over the years would like to see them not play again for them this season. There is precedent for that. In 2010, three football players from UCLA, the first day of their freshman in summer school, freshman recruits were caught stealing a backpack out of a dorm cafeteria, and they were immediately thrown off the team for the season, immediately. And so there's precedent for that. However, so I expected UCLA to do that. They did not do that. They said it. The operative coach said it was indefinite suspension. So obviously they are probably still discussing that, and that mm-hmm. is a very big concern for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, are they crucial to the team's success, these three?
Well, there's the fact that there's three of them makes them, you know, none of them were starters, and none of them were going to be stars this year. But three people out of, you know, Steve only plays like 8 or 9 players generally anyway. So that's like a third of his team would be gone. They would lose a lot of depth, a lot of bench strength. They would, yes, it would be, I'd say without them, the team probably has very little chance of winning much this year. You know, I mean, they're going to have a winning season, but they'll probably have very little chance of going very far in the postseason in March Madness. So yes, yeah. In that sense, they are crucial.
Okay, so they're saying, well, they're suspended while UCLA pursues its own investigation. So, I mean...
Right. But what bothers me about this, Madeline, is that the football team, this is an extracurricular activity. So UCLA can decide whatever they want to do, student affairs, code of conduct, all that. The basketball team is a separate issue. Just throw them off the team. He can do that. They could do that without going through student affairs. They could tell somebody, you can't be in a marching band, you can't be a cheerleader, you can't be in the football team or basketball team. They can do that. They don't. That student affairs thing is a cop out. I think that there's some resistance. I think a lot of people there want them gone for the year. There's some resistance, and they're trying to work that out now. But they should be gone for the year, in my opinion. If precedent is right, the university has any in its integrity, they should not play a game for them this season.
Do we even know what they stole?
We don't know what they stole, but what we learned out how they stole it and where they stole it from, and it was pretty startling. We thought it was just a pair of sunglasses from Louis Vuitton, not that that's small, but we thought it was a pair of sunglasses from a Louis Vuitton store. Well, it turns out they shoplifted from they took stuff back to their hotel.
They shoplifted from three stores? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, three. Yes, that's been confirmed by them. They confirmed it. Mm-hmm. Dan Guerrero, so they stole from three different stores. So it's a little more than a lapse in judgment. And then they had the Chinese police came back and had to search the bags of the hotel and the team bus in Georgia Tech, the team they were playing in China, before the players never fessed up.
Yeah.
Doing it. And then again, they had the President Trump and the Chinese.
Okay, you're going in and out. Unfortunately, we're losing you. But okay. Just let me ask you this one last question. So, okay, these guys, as they say, they exhibited really poor judgment and then they didn't fess up to it when they probably should have. But they are 17, 18, and 19. They are young. Do you cut them any slack for that?
Right. Well, yeah, I think you cut them slack by not putting them off the team altogether. You're talent.
Okay. Okay, Bill, I'm sorry, but we keep losing you, so we're just going to have to end this conversation, unfortunately. But I think we get the general idea. Bill Plaschke wanting them to be suspended for the entire season, the whole year. Bill Plaschke, sports columnist for the LA Times. An Earth-sized planet has been discovered, about 11 light years away from us. Scientists writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics say it could be warm enough to sustain life if it happens to have the right atmosphere, if TBD. Well, if there is life out there beyond our solar system, it seems China will probably be the first to communicate with it. China has built the world's largest radio dish in order to search for extraterrestrial life. It is the size of 5 football fields, and the Atlantic Science, Technology, and Health editor Ross Anderson went there to check it out. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so Ross, you met up with China's preeminent science fiction writer to visit the dish. His name is Liu Cixin, and he wrote The Three-Body Problem. Apparently, Barack Obama is a fan. Why does a sci-fi writer have access to this kind of science project, and why is he consulting with the government on it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Liu's career has just taken off so spectacularly in the last 10 years or so. As you mentioned, President Obama has sung his praises in the New York Times of all places, and he's become just a massive seller and won all these crazy awards, et cetera, et cetera. He really is this sort of, you know, on cosmic matters, he's the big star there. So it is no surprise that, you know, we could quibble with how much his consultation is valued versus maybe just his association with these projects, that the government is sort of eager to have him there. But he is a consultant indeed.
Okay. Well, how is he consulting? What is he telling the Chinese government about extraterrestrial life?
Well, if he's telling them what he told me, he is saying that we should be quite wary of making contact with extraterrestrial life because, according to him, that is the most dangerous thing that could happen to humans as a species.
Really? Why? Because they wouldn't come in peace?
He doesn't think they would come in peace, not because they were essentially that they were just like these warlike aliens or anything like that, but because if they were thinking coolly and rationally about it, they would inevitably see any other civilization as a threat, in part because another civilization might perceive them as a threat. He sort of thinks that it'd be quite easy to have a cosmic misunderstanding if you're trying to communicate across the distance of light years. And so as a result, it would be quite easy for people to get their signals crossed and something bad to happen.
Well, that is such a human way of looking at it, right? I mean, they might have a completely different perspective.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. In fact, I sort of, in this piece, kind of play the foil to his pessimism. Perhaps naively, I guess, think that any civilization that has sort of survived quite a long time in the cosmos and has the technology to get in touch and perhaps visit is sort of bound to be older and wiser, in my view. But as I said, that could be a naive view.
Okay, well, in real life, the Chinese government really does think that they need to be prepared to receive these signals, should there be such signals issued from out there?
Sure, and they're not alone in that. I mean, there have been international protocols for if we were to receive a message from an extraterrestrial intelligence for decades now. And SETI itself, SETI being the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is a scientific endeavor that dates back to the early 1960s. Project Ozma in West Virginia started pointing radio dishes at faraway stars and listening for messages from them. So this is something that people have been thinking about for a number, I mean, certainly in the literature, centuries, but as a practical matter for decades.
So they build this big dish, this gigantic dish, and they displaced 9,000 people who live there, 9,000 villagers to
yeah.
build it?
That's
extraordinary.
Right. I know, and quite costly, too. I think it drove the price up by, I want to say, tens of millions of dollars just to move all these people, and they gave them some kind of subsidy. It's interesting. Some of them actually complained about their shoddy new housing and created sort of a ripple of bad press there, which is pretty rare for a government project. I remember being like in my hotel lobby in Beijing. The newspapers are obviously written by the party. It's really funny. They're like five paragraphs, you know, Xi Jinping visits factory and gives inspiring speech. So for them to have bad press is quite a thing.
Well, okay, so they go to all this effort, they build this huge thing, and is it really just for the remote, and I mean remote, possibility that there might be some contact sometime in the future, or are they going to use this for other stuff, more practical
stuff
right
now? They're going to use it for other stuff, yeah. Just in the realm of the sciences, radio astronomy has many targets, be it black holes or galaxies outside the Milky Way or pulsars or any number of others. Lots of astronomical bodies in the universe give off radio waves, and they'll be looking to catch those radio waves so we can learn more about the universe. There are also some potential national security uses they might put it to. But what's significant about them making the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, like one of the main science goals for this dish, is that no one has done that with a big flagship national observatory before.
Well, what does the U.S. think of this?
Well, interestingly, so as we know, we have a Republican Congress right now, and for whatever there are other deficiencies when it comes to the sciences, Republicans in Congress are quite fond of looking for life in the universe. It's one of the things that they sort of think that NASA should be getting back to doing. And so I've even heard some sort of back channel off the record whispers that they're looking to fund SETI again through Congress, which would be quite a thing. Now, whether that was partly inspired by the appearance of this Chinese dish, I can't say.
Because they cut off funding in the early 90s, right?
That's right. You know, SETI emerged, as I said, in the 1960s, and then mainly through Carl Sagan being its main evangelist in the 1970s and 80s, achieved something of a cultural prominence, I think. And what's interesting is, I think, as you say, if you're looking at any one star, it's quite a remote chance that you're going to find a message. And so most people who work on this problem are just, you know, you can never talk to them without them being at pains to explain that this is likely to be a 1,000 or a 10,000 year search, you know, even if it is successful. And so I think there was a natural cycle where people had been hearing about this for a few decades. It hadn't yielded any immediate fruit. And so in the early 1990s, yes, it became sort of a whipping boy for a number of Republican senators, actually, and they defunded it altogether in the U.S.
Well, it does seem a little kooky, I mean, just on the face of it.
I'd ask you why.
Well, first of all, and may I be completely superficial here, the name SETI sounds a little kooky.
Oh,
because it sounds
it's only an acronym.
I know.
Oh, okay.
It brings to mind kind of... made up.
So it's a branding problem.
Well, there's that. But there's also the idea of, more seriously, of you're spending all this money in this vague hope of hearing some kind of contact and hoping that it's the particular kind of contact that you've set your machines up to receive. It might not be that kind of contact at all. And then meanwhile, our own planet needs some help immediately.
I think that's it's always a question as to what we ought to be investing as a kind of a relative matter between, you know, sort of earthly problems and trying to answer these grand cosmic questions. But I guess I would suggest that one of the reasons that life on Earth is, and particularly human life, is so worth nurturing is precisely because we sort of strive at these larger questions.
So you're okay with this big project?
I'm okay with it. I'm into it.
You're into it.
I think it's cool.
Cool. All right. Ross Anderson. Ross Anderson at The Atlantic, science, technology, and health editor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Madeline.
Yeah, SETI. It does sound like Yeti. I'm just putting that out there. Okay, coming up, writer Daniel Alarcón on his new book of short stories where young men are the main characters.
You know, male ego takes people into terrible places, makes men do terrible things.
Daniel Alarcón next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Author Daniel Alarcón is a man of many identities. He was born in Peru, but grew up near Birmingham, Alabama. He now lives in New York, where he teaches at Columbia University's Journalism School. And when he's not teaching or hosting the Spanish language podcast Radio Ambulante, he's writing fiction in both Spanish and in English. Alarcón regularly explores themes like social upheaval, migration, how we tie our identity to where we're from, where we live. Those ideas are all present in Alarcón's new collection of short stories. It's out now. It's called The King is Always Above the People, and it was longlisted for this year's National Book Award. And Daniel Alarcón joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
Okay, the title, The King is Always Above the People, that refers to an unnamed dictator in one of your short stories, the eponymous short story, who was killed by hanging and a crowd looking up at his dead body. Tell us more about that title and what you wanted to say with it.
Yeah, it comes from a postcard in the story. It's sort of totemic, and it's in where the protagonist of that story is working. He sells these postcards that commemorate the hanging of this dictator. The image itself was a drawing by this Iranian cartoonist, Ardeher Moassis, and he has this great book called Life in Iran. I liked the image because the disconnect between the words and the image. So it appears to be a phrase sort of supporting traditional power structures, and the actual image that goes along with it, while accurately described, is completely different. And the meaning is completely different. And I liked that subversion. It's really a story about power and about power structures and about patriarchy. And I'd realize I just made it sound like a sociology textbook and super boring, but I think it actually isn't.
No, it's not. And it seems, and it's you know, small in the sense that it's about a guy who goes to the city and he's living in the small room and he's kind of trying to remake his life, and his old life comes back to reclaim him.
Yeah, yeah. And he wants to reinvent himself. I mean, and what he's raging against is this inability to make a clean break from the past. You know, it is not just the story, but the book in general, I think, is a lot about people in transit, people in the process of reinvention. And yeah, he's certainly one of them.
Right. So the idea of leaving the small town for the capital or even for the United States, that is a theme in many of these stories. And I was wondering if you could talk about the provincials. And this is where a young man and his dad return to their small town after the young man's uncle dies. They're sort of, you know, taking care of his affairs, and they spend a night at the local bar, and the locals there kind of greet them as returning heroes, and yet they resent them at the same time for having left their town, and they see them as kind of supercilious. And then the young man and his father basically invent a story that he has been successful, this young man. He's moved to the United States, which is considered the ultimate success. Can you talk about why that is seen as the ultimate success and why they have to feel like they have to invent that story for these locals?
You know, my father grew up in a town called Arequipa, and part of his family lives in a small beach town called Mollendo. And I was, you know, traveling north from Chile up to Lima, and I passed through Mollendo, and I was like, oh, I'll look up my family. And I lived a scene very much like what this character lives in the sense that, you know, I was paraded around the plaza as, you know, Renato's son, and the myth of my father in this town, of like how brilliant he was, how intelligent he was. You know, everyone was talking about it for hours and hours and hours everywhere I went. And I didn't know what to do with that feeling because I didn't feel like I'd earned it in any way. It just felt ripe for dramatizing in a certain way.
Did you feel kind of guilty?
Yeah, I felt...
Or ashamed or anything like that?
Not ashamed. You know, it's just everyone, I think, has felt provincial at a certain point. It's just such a relative term, you know? And, you know, the story really does, I think, try to interrogate that idea. And, of course, the protagonist and narrator is, I think, you know, you said the word supercilious. I mean, he is. He's a jerk. He's a haughty and snobby and elitist, and yet, you know, he's felt provincial all his life compared to his brother, and he impersonates his brother in order to escape that feeling. And then in the story, he's reminded very clearly that that's not who he is.
Well, he's an actor, and
right,
you know, he says it was an act, and then his dad says, "But what isn't?" And then he says, or you write, what he meant was people perform sorrow for a reason. And so he's talking about the death of this, you know, this guy, Joselito, that they come across as they're traveling to this town and they see a funeral procession, or they see people mourning his death. And I guess I'm wondering if you are conflating this idea of how we perform sorrow and death with migration. Like, there's kind of a moving from one place to the other and a leaving behind and a death of one way of life while you search for another.
Hmm. I mean, that's an interesting read. I think that you can certainly make that interpretation. I hadn't connected those in that way. I mean, I think it's always interesting, you know, the people who are left behind have a role to play, and almost like a culturally specific role that is demanded, in that and the immigrant who returns has a role to play. And part of what the story is trying to do is sort of examine those roles and point out how false they can be and how problematic they can be.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Daniel Alarcón. He's written a new book of short stories called The King is Always Above the People. And I'm wondering also about the vantage point, because most of these stories, if not all, are written from a male point of view, very male point of view. And the women are kind of, I don't know, they're kind of side characters.
I think that's fair, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, fair analysis of my story, not fair.
Abandoned girlfriends. Gender politics. Waitresses or...
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I didn't realize until I was putting the stories together. It's certainly not true of my previous work. It was true of this book. It felt like it was coming together in a way that was very male. Yeah, I think you're right. I think all the protagonists and narrators are men.
But are you trying to say something about the identity of migrants, or that men are searching for this place of importance, and that's particularly weighs on them to do that? Or
no, I mean, I'm never trying to say anything. I'm always like trying to sort of listen very carefully to what my characters want to say. And I think what happens when you put a collection together is that you look back at, you know, the 10, 20 stories you've written and start putting them together, and you can see the obsessions that you've had that you didn't even realize you had, that are playing out again and again in the pages. And it did strike me that this was a collection that is dealing with masculinity and maleness and male roles. And it wasn't sort of like something that I knew that I'd been thinking about. It just became clear when I was putting the collection together. I mean, you know, male ego takes people into terrible places, makes men do terrible things.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of your characters seem stuck, like not really knowing what to do with themselves.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't? Who doesn't feel like there's another version of your life out there that's slightly better? I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't feel that way at certain points. That doesn't mean you're not, you know, happy or whatever. It's just that, you know, daydreaming about other lives is just part of being human, isn't it?
Yeah. But put that in the context of a political context with the migration from south to north, and it's an interesting parallel between the personal and the political.
Yeah, and so much of my work has been thinking about that, because, you know, if everyone was always thinking about sort of that other life that might be there, that might exist, for someone who is the child of immigrants, it's very clear, you can clearly imagine, or you can clearly see the moment that your life shifted, right? So my family left in 1980, came to the United States. I was 3 years old, and you can say without a doubt, I can say unequivocally that changed the shape of my life, right? And that I would be a different person if we'd stayed, you know. I wonder about that. And so much of my sort of literary project, to the extent that I have one, has been thinking about that and trying to play out different versions of my life if I'd stayed.
What do you think you would have been had you stayed in Peru?
They're all in the stories. I think, you know, you want to believe that there's some essence of your character that is unchangeable, you know, that's what makes it your essence. maybe, oh God, Madeline, it's a tough question.
Well, yeah.
It's just a funny speculative game. I think that it's easier to do if I'm like, oh, let me create these characters and just put them in motion and just see what happens. But no one, you know, there's such glamour in leaving, you know? There's glamour in leaving and returning. It's the living on the other part that isn't glamorous on the other side, right?
Yeah.
But no one has to see that. No one wants to see that.
Even if they know it's true deep down.
Yeah. Even if they know it's true deep down. And even if they know that their life is just as unglamorous as anyone else's.
Okay. So these aren't the most uplifting stories.
Madeline, I feel, yeah. Are they not? I don't know. I don't know. They don't seem terribly sad to me. But what do I know? I'm just happy that I wrote them. That's the funny thing is when you write something, you're so proud that it's of it and so relieved that it's out of you that the individual emotional content of each story, as it might strike a reader, is irrelevant. Like, it's just not part of your calculus. Mm. So it isn't part of my calculus. So I'm just like, you could write the saddest story ever. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, that was great. So glad I wrote that.
Because you finished it.
Because I finished it and got it out of me, and now
so
I don't
have
to be sad
about it. So it's a happy
ending for you. Yes, because I'm not sad about it anymore because I wrote it.
Well, Danielle, it's been really fun talking with you and uplifting.
I hope so. I really hope so. Thanks, Madeline. Appreciate it.
Danielle Alarcón, his new book is called The King is Always Above the People. I love the music choices. Coming up, why Christie's hyped a Leonardo da Vinci painting, which may not be a real Leonardo. It went for $450 million at auction. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Last night, an unknown bidder paid the highest price ever recorded at an art auction for an apparent long-lost Leonardo da Vinci painting.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, we move to the Leonardo da Vinci, the Salvator Mundi.
The painting is called Salvator Mundi, or Savior of the World. It shows Jesus raising his right hand and holding a crystal orb.
$370 million. Back to Francois's client. At $370 million, ladies and gentlemen. $400 million.
It went for $450 million. $450 million. For some perspective, the United States spends $320 million a year in aid to Mexico. But could the painting be a fake? Some people are questioning its authenticity, including Jerry Saltz, senior art critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so before we get to these questions of whether it's a fake or not, its authenticity, what was this auction like? Who was there?
Well, pictures testify that it might have been the whitest room in Christendom last night. Stars like Leonardo DiCaprio, the big wigs of industry, art movers and shakers, advisors, everybody was there to ooh and ah and gasp, which they did.
Well, because there was quite a buildup to this auction, right?
I'll say they traveled the painting all around the world to prime the collector pump, calling it, among other things, you know, a male Mona Lisa, probably more valuable than a petrochemical plant. That was a new one on me, akin to the discovery of a new planet. So
this was in the paperwork for this? Is this Christie's promotional material?
If you go to their site, if they haven't taken them down, you can see these on videotapes, especially in Hong Kong. It's interesting that they do call it the male Mona Lisa to shift the emphasis away from any religious subject matter. It's very subtle what they were doing, and it seems to work. We wished a Leonardo into existence. It's like the Shroud of Turin, I suppose.
But there are very few around, right?
Experts estimate there are 15 to 20 on this earth.
And this one was rediscovered recently,
This was rediscovered after even what Christie's very, again, subtly doesn't mention is that the attributions over the centuries have read possibly commissioned, possibly by descent, by whom possibly brought it to England, etc. So even the provenance of the painting, which they say, you know, it dates from 1500, I think is highly suspect and will eventually come out. But yes, it was whatever this was missing since for the last several hundred years.
And why? What happened to it?
No one knows. I would tell you, because it wasn't a very good work, that it really did disappear, wasn't taken care of. All evidence points to over 75% of the paint being missing from it, it being gouged, scratched, a hand changed here and then there. There was a beard, and then it was gone, then it was back, and now it's gone again. So it's a pretty iffy history, and again, wished into existence as a fishy Da Vinci, I think.
A fishy Da Vinci. All right, we're going to get to that in just a sec, but I have one more question before we get to that. Why was it sold in the modern and contemporary auction, even though this is an old master's painting?
Well, that is the question. It's a horrifying idea. If there are only 15 to 20 Leonardos, this is a painting above all other things in Western civilization that you would want not at auction, but somehow placed into the public hands for the public good into a museum somehow, somewhere. And for Christie's to swoop in and do this last night after the auction, they said, we've made history. I would say you've made fake history.
And this was sold by the estate of a Russian billionaire, right?
I believe so.
And we don't know who bought it.
Of course not.
Well, no institutions bid on it. Does that say something?
It says that no institution on the planet could afford this kind of astronomical, obscene amount of money to spend on what I think is a questionable, dubious attribution.
Okay, let's get to that. What is your evidence?
Well, first of all, I have no degrees. I am not an art historian. I've been looking at art for 50 years, and the second I saw this painting, I thought, this surface is dull, dead, inert, nothing like an old master, nothing like a Leonardo. In all of Leonardo's, he's never posed a figure sort of olden like that, looking dead on straight at you. He was a great inventor, born in 1452. He's already painted the Last Supper by then. He is a master of turning figures in space, very complex poses, arms that involute in on themselves, space that turns around. He's never painted a figure like that, and in his entire career, never did a drawing or a painting remotely like this, and never one of Jesus Christ. Now, there are two real and very gorgeous drawings of drapery that Leonardo did do that resemble very closely the way the drapery in this painting falls off the arm. However, it would have been an almost everyday occurrence in Leonardo's studio then for him to be making drawings exactly like that, showing them to his students and the people working in the studio to show them, frankly, how it's done. At the very, very best, I'll grant Christie's that maybe if it was made in his studio, maybe Leonardo picked up a brush and went, "You idiot, never paint a hand like that," and put a few brush strokes in. He would never paint the subject. May I add something else?
Yes.
Leonardo at the time is the most famous artist in the world, and there's a lot of documentation on everything he did. He kept 7,000 pages of notebooks, and there is absolutely no record of him working on this commission, on this painting, on this subject, nowhere.
Well, doesn't Christie's and other auction houses, don't they have a responsibility to provide the genuine artifact?
They have a responsibility, it turns out, to their shareholders. If you read the disclaimers, and there are layers of them, they're written very, very subtly, that there's no way you could really catch it. But they have met their legal responsibility, I'm sure, when this thing one day is discovered not to be a Leonardo. They're covered for, you know, part of this lifetime. Anyway, scholarship changes on these things once every 15 years, and maybe in another time there'll be art historians that will stand up. There already are. If you look in the great British journal devoted to just this, Art Watch UK, they've already produced one great article pretty much taking apart that this painting could even remotely be, quote, a new Leonardo worth as much as a petrochemical plant.
Jerry Saltz, senior art critic for New York Magazine and Vulture. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, Christian Bordahl. Hello there.
Hey there.
You weren't that anonymous buyer, were you?
Madeline, don't out me.
Yes,
just a little bit of my fortune spent on that fake Leonardo. Well, you talked earlier with LA Times sports columnist Bill Plaschke about those three UCLA freshman basketball players that shoplifted in China.
Right.
LiAngelo Ball, Jalen Hill, Cody Riley, they're home again now. UCLA is deciding how they're going to punish them, and they haven't quite decided yet. I figured our listeners would want to get in on that and then have some suggestions.
I'm sure they
do. So we asked them. There is a lot of tough love out there, Madeline, I have to tell you. Richard Huntington, they admitted guilt, case closed. They shouldn't just be suspended from the team, they should be expelled. And Trump shouldn't have done anything about it. Like any citizen that travels internationally and commits a crime, let them do the time. What makes these idiots special? Griffith Goldstein says they're from America, so it should be taken care of here in the USA. However, I think they should be expelled. Susan Land, at the very least, they should not play basketball for UCLA ever again. Will Hawkins, all three players should be expelled. Larry Sachnowitz, immediate expulsion from the UC system. They took the place
no
of many other deserving students. There's no mercy out there. They should be kicked out of school, says Monique Johnson. Christian Thomas, expelled. Patricia Ferrer, expelled. James Patrick, UCLA needs to do the right thing and expel them. What would John Wooden say? Well,
wow.
Ling Lu says their scholarships should be taken away. He's an UCLA alum. That's a little bit milder. Cherry Heuerbaum says give their scholarships to students in need. Lucille Pena says community service and a few games suspensions if not the season. I like Camille Simon. She says apply the rules they have in place. Their humiliation will be enough punishment to last a lifetime. Does that make me a softie if I
think it
like
does.
That one?
But they did spend the night in a Chinese jail.
They didn't spend the night. They got released the same day, but they spent a whole week, you know, with their team having left, wondering, like, are we going to be staying here in China and going to prison?
They did cause an international incident.
They did cause an international incident. Yes, yes, they did. And they're 17, 18, 19-year-old freshmen.
Okay, you're
freshmen.
A softie. You
okay,
are.
I guess I am.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Thanks, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.